Cadogan Hall in London, and it's presented by Catherine Bott.
Welcome to Cadogan Hall for Proms Saturday Matinee number 4. Today we're devoting ourselves to Schumann in his bicentenary year, and the National Ensemble will end the concert with his piano quartet. First, though, a work by Robin Holloway that was inspired by, and indeed incorporates, Schumann's song cycle, Liederkreis, Opus 24. Liederkreis means simply song cycle. This particular cycle comes from Schumann's Year of Song, 1840, the year he married Clara Wieck. The work by Robin Holloway that we're going to hear now, Fantasy Pieces, was written in 1971 for a silver wedding anniversary celebration. To tell us about the gestation of the work and its inspiration, who better than the composer himself? Please welcome Robin Holloway. Robin, thank you very much for joining me and all the listeners here in Cadogan Hall and on Radio 3. Let's get straight to the point. What inspired you to write a work around Liederkreis, Opus 24?
Well, it was a commission, actually. It was a specific commission for a member of the audience who'd heard a previous piece of mine in the Cheltenham Festival called Scenes from Schumann, and he liked it so much he wanted more of the same to celebrate his silver wedding in 1971. And I'm hoping that Mr. Graham Jones, the original commissioner of the Fantasy Pieces, is here in the audience today, nearly 40 years on. So he wanted a bit more of the same. No composer wants to write more of the same, but I was fascinated by the idea of playing around further with Schumann songs in a different kind of way, for a very different sort of occasion, and for chamber group, as we see on the stage, rather than full orchestra.
And what about the themes of the songs in this cycle?
The work incorporates, ideally, as today, the Schumann song cycle complete. What we have is a prelude by me, an instrumental prelude, which sets the scene in a few solemn chords. Then we get the complete Schumann cycle, and then, without a break, the instrumental commentaries. Listen carefully to the Schumann songs, take in all the themes, you'll have all the material by which the transformations are taking place. The prelude is the prelude to his last song, that then becomes first in the whole scheme. The last song itself is the only song that I don't play around with. The last song of the Schumann cycle stands alone. It's only heard the once. It's sort of sacred, a kind of farewell to the beautiful love scene that's been told in the Heine verses, and it stands all by itself. Otherwise, all the material that's going to be transformed before your ears will be heard in its original form.
Robin, thank you very much. And now, while you go to take your comfy seat, just around here and down the stairs, we will, all the performers are ready. They are all on the stage now. Fantasy Pieces on the Heine Liederkreis of Schumann, to give it its full title, is scored for 12 players, and as Robin said just now, it frames a complete performance of Schumann's Liederkreis Opus 24. Performing it now, the Nash Ensemble, pianist Ian Brown and tenor Toby Spence, with conductor Edward Gardner.
Thank you. Thank you. das Herz ermann, ach, hörst du, wie's pochet im Kämmerlein? Da hauset ein Zimmermann schlimm und arg, der zimmert mir einen Es hämmert und klopfet bei Tag und bei Nacht, es hat mich schon längst um den Schlaf gebracht. Ach, spottet euch Meister Zimmermann, damit ich bald schlafen kann.
Yeah.
Abschied von Europa und von ihr. Blut verring aus meinen Augen, Blut verquillt aus meinem Leib, dass ich mit dem heißen Blute meine Schmerzen niederschreib. Liedchen von der Schlange im Paradies. Sauberbahn, die Blas
Robin Holloway's fantasy pieces on the Heine Liederkreis of Schumann were performed by tenor Toby Spence, pianist Ian Brown, and the Nash Ensemble conducted by Edward Gardner. Now, before we move on to the other piece in today's programme, there has to be, I've just thought of an oxymoron that Stephen Fry would commend me for, a certain amount of unobtrusive kerfuffle on the stage. And so I'm very happy to say that Robin Holloway, having taken the well-deserved plaudits from an enthusiastic audience here at Cadogan Hall, has agreed to stay on stage with me. And Robin, I'm going to step right into the lion's den and pretend I'm in one of your tutorials in Cambridge. This is really taking my life in my hands. Did I spot? I know this piece isn't about quotes and paraphrases because you've described it as making abstract forms out of song material. But did I hear a tender and affecting quote from Frauenliebe und Leben in the middle?
You certainly did. Yes.
Oh, good.
Yes. In the middle section of my second movement, the big adagio on the Schumann adagio song, there's a kind of recitative middle section, and across that flits the ghost of Frauenliebe und Leben, the first bar, bom bom bom, and a fragment from the Dichterliebe, an exceptionally tender moment from the Dichterliebe. In fact, I have to confess, the original commission for this piece was to do something with Frauenliebe und Leben, and I simply couldn't do that because it was for a wedding anniversary, for a silver wedding. So that was the suitable, the beloved cycle. And I felt that it was untouchable. Two, it didn't suggest compositional possibilities. But I worked that little bit in anyway, as you acutely heard. And then it comes. Did you hear it in the finale as well?
Yes, I did.
Yes.
I'm showing off now.
Yeah. In the finale, it lies underneath all the harmony, whereas in the first bit, it's kind of subliminally flickering through on the top.
Well, that piece seemed, to my ears, to reflect Schumann in that it was affecting and touching and unsettling in equal measure. We're now going to move on to a piece by Schumann, not by Holloway, and I want to throw some words back at you from your soon-to-be-much-missed column in the Spectator magazine. Your last article was about Schumann, and you've said, Schumann is probably the most lovable of the great German masters. Schubert's range is broader, his depth more profound. Schumann, within narrow confines, reaches the most secret places with the most intimate touch. Can you elaborate on that a little?
I really think it speaks for itself, Catherine. But I think his composer, every individual feels that he's speaking uniquely to him or her. There's something about that. It's the least possible, at his greatest, I think, at his most affecting, it's the least possible of a public, rhetorical, applause-seeking kind of art. And of course we know this is true from the circumstances of his life. You know, most of his early music is addressed to one person only in the whole world. Okay, there was a succession of earlier loves, but eventually it was Clara and Clara alone who was the recipient of his first and most intimate thoughts. Then an audience follows on, but in a sense we all share with Clara something of that speaking to you alone.
Well, we're moving on to a piece written for Clara. Meanwhile, Robin Holloway, thank you very much. The other work in today's Proms Saturday matinee is from another great single-minded year in Schumann's life, 1842, his year of chamber music. His wife Clara has been called his inspiration, his innamorata, and his finest interpreter. And Schumann, having just completed three string quartets, wanted to combine that lineup with a piano part for her to play. First came the Great Quintet, a daring, pioneering, histrionic work, and Schumann followed it just a month later with this quartet for piano, violin, viola, and cello, a scoring with significant precursors in Mozart and Beethoven. The work was first performed in December 1844 in Schumann's farewell concert in the Leipzig Gewandhaus before his move to Düsseldorf. And with hindsight, it was perhaps the end of the happiest and most productive time of his life. Let's go back to Robin Holloway's wise words for a moment. One never senses that, as in Schubert, this composer is untimely cut off with indescribable potential riches still to yield. In Schumann, the feeling of dilution, then guttering out, is palpable and unmistakable. But let's not close on a downer. Wherever its centre is located, this body of work has moved music lovers in a unique manner, and always will. Now, to play Schumann's Piano Quartet in E-flat major, Opus 47, we welcome back members of the Nash Ensemble, violinist Benjamin Nabarro, viola player Lawrence Power, cellist Paul Watkins, and pianist Ian Brown.
Thank you.
Schumann's piano quartet in E-flat was played by members of the Nash Ensemble, Benjamin Nabarro, Lawrence Power, Paul Watkins and Ian Brown. There's more music by Schumann and by Robin Holloway in Prom number 74 on September the 9th. The Prom's Schumann Bicentenary Survey ends with his Introduction and Allegro Appassionato, a piano concerto in all but name, and with it, Robin Holloway's Reliquary, which draws on Schumann's last bleak song cycle, to words by Mary Queen of Scots. Meanwhile, our final Saturday matinee offers more perspectives on music of the past by composers of today, so do try and join me for that, and even sooner for Monday lunchtime's Proms chamber music recital of Janáček and Schubert, given by pianist Lars Vogt. Meanwhile, for more good listening this afternoon, it's back to Broadcasting House and David Cornett.
Thank you, Catherine. Catherine Bolt at Cadogan Hall this afternoon. Well, coming up next here this afternoon on BBC Radio 3 at 4:45 is Jazz Library. Tim Richards joins Alan Shipton to discuss the recorded legacy of the American pianist Wynton Kelly. We have time for some piano music, transcriptions of the music of Johann Strauss. And this is a transcription by Moritz Rosenthal on the Blue Danube, and it's played by Konstantin Scherbakov.
Thank you.
Danube, transcribed by Moritz Rosenthal, played by Konstantin Shabakov.
At the BBC Proms this week, there's the last of the season's visiting youth orchestras. Herbert Blomstedt conducts the Gustav Mahler Youth Orchestra in Bruckner's last unfinished symphony and Mahler's youthful song cycle with the lovelorn Wayfaring Lad. And to begin the evening, Hindemith's vivid symphonic picture of a heroic artist. The BBC Proms continue on Wednesday at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
And now it's time for Jazz Library with Alan Shipton, which this week explores the career of one of the great blues players of the music.
From the best-selling jazz album of all time, Kind of Blue, this is Freddie Freeloader by the Miles Davis Band in 1959, with the subject of today's Jazz Library, Wynton Kelly, on piano. That's the piano solo from Freddie Freeloader from Kind of Blue, the Miles Davis Sextet with John Coltrane, Cannonball Adderley, Paul Chambers, Jimmy Cobb and Wynton Kelly in March 1959. To discuss the music of Wynton Kelly, I'm joined by pianist Tim Richards. Tim, welcome back to Jazz Library, and let's start by considering this album, because Wynton only appears on this track, otherwise it's Bill Evans, isn't it?
Yeah, that's right. In fact, I think Bill Evans technically had left the Miles Davis band at this point and Wynton was his replacement. And for some reason, Miles Davis didn't tell Wynton that Bill Evans was going to be doing most of the dates. So when he arrived in the studio, I think he was a bit miffed to find another piano player sitting at the piano. But Miles obviously planned him to play on this one track for whatever reason. And listening to it, you can really tell why.
It's quite unusual for the time, because thinking about the format which that band tended to adopt both on record and in live shows, normally the piano player doesn't get a chance to solo until much, much, much later in the track.
I.e. last, yes. Well, maybe Miles felt that as Wynton was only going to be on one track, he'd put him up the front as kind of compensation.
Let's try now to look at how Wynton arrived at this job by going back and tracing his career from the beginning of the 1950s. I think his first significant recordings were for Blue Note back in 1951. So we'll start with those sessions. Tim, which one have you chosen and why?
Well, one of the things that's interesting about Wynton is the fact that he was Jamaican and only moved to New York when he was four. So we don't really know what music they would have been listening to, but I suspect there would have been some Jamaican music in there. And I never heard this record before preparing for this programme, and it was a revelation to me because You don't hear nearly so much bluesy playing as one has become used to with Wynton Kelly. One of the defining characteristics of his style is this easy swing and blues, whereas these early trio recordings, it reminded me of Billy Taylor or Nat King Cole. There was far less of this bluesy phrasing and a lot of interesting block chords and quite fast, light touch, fast playing that I would associate with those players. Is there anyone else that springs to mind that you could compare it with?
Well, elsewhere on the list, not the track we're going to hear, there are echoes of Bud Powell and Al Haig in the very fleet right-hand playing, and I think Wynton was always a linear right-hand player. But the track you've chosen does, as you say, exemplify the block chords and also the Jamaican heritage.
Yeah, that's why I chose it, really, just because it's a great example of a non-swing track. And if you listen to the bass player, who was Oscar Pettiford, a very fine bass player, he plays almost a reggae or a ska bass line. He never plays the one. If you listen to the bass, it's a really interesting bass line, and it sounds very Latin, of course, as well. And check out the block chords later on in the solo.
Not written as a Latin song, this is Rodgers and Hart's Where or When. Where or When, and that's from the complete Blue Note Trio Sessions by Wynton Kelly on the Jazz Factory label. The same material also out from Proper under A Proper Introduction to Wynton Kelly. The band, Wynton Kelly on piano, Oscar Pettiford bass and Leo Abrams drums in July 1951. And, Tim, I think Wynton was a mere child when he made these recordings.
He was definitely an early achiever, yes. I think he was 19 when he made those. Incredibly self-assured playing for somebody that young. He'd had quite a lot of experience already playing with Dinah Washington and others. He did various rhythm and blues gigs as well, which is why I was so surprised that this was so unbluesy, most of the tracks on this album. Definitely worth checking out, though.
It's interesting, isn't it, that Alfred Lion and Frank Wolfe at Blue Note in this time in the early 50s always had their ear to the ground for pianists. I mean, they were recording Herbie Nichols and various other relatively unknown people they're recording, and they were very quick to spot Wynton Kelly's talent.
Indeed, yes. Even so, he didn't make another record under his own name for a number of years, did he?
He didn't, because, as you say, he was working with Dinah and various other people. We're going to pick him up after his time in the services and after his time with various other bands with what was his first really high-profile instrumental job, as opposed to accompanying a singer or playing for a soloist, and that's with Dizzy Gillespie's State Department Big Band in the mid-1950s. Now, I think Walter Davis had also played piano in this band, but Wynton Kelly came in 1957, and there's one glorious example of him playing at the Newport Jazz Festival with them on a track that was featured recently on Jazz Library in the Al Gray programme. Well, sadly, because it's such a long track, I faded it out right after Al's solo, but that's when Wynton begins. You've written books about blues piano, Tim, but it's a great exemplar on how to come up with chorus after chorus of blues invention.
Indeed, yes. At a fast tempo as well. You can hear the invention just coming at you. Every chorus has a fresh idea, and he never runs out of momentum. He never plays a clunker, does he? Every phrase is perfectly conceived, and I think that's a hallmark of his style, his perfect consistency all the way. That's why he was so popular as a sideman, I think.
Now, you talked about the fact that in the Blue Note recordings we don't hear much of the linear bluesy style, but certainly by 1957, this is some 6 years after the records we just heard, that's crystallised. This is really Wynton as he's going to be playing on up-tempo pieces from now on.
Exactly, yes, you can definitely hear he's starting to find his own voice now.
The other thing that impresses me about this, and it's perhaps one of the great underrated rhythm sections of all time, is that Paul West on bass, and particularly Charlie Persip on drums, really boot this band along. It's a fantastic feel to the rhythm section in front of this boisterous crowd at Newport.
Indeed. We'll be right back.
Dizzy Gillespie Big Band at the Newport Jazz Festival in July 1957 with Dizzy's Blues, and I've taken that from the 3-CD set Dizzy's Diamonds on Verve, though it's also available on a recent Avid issue called Four Classic Albums by Dizzy Gillespie, and that whole Newport session is included on the 2-CD Avid set. Well, you mentioned, Tim, that Wynton Kelly didn't record under his own name for some considerable time after those early Blue Note sessions in 1951. We're going to pick him up round about the moment that he joined Miles Davis, but under the next album that he made under his own name for Riverside, or in Keep News, often somebody who signed up pianists who had worked for Blue Note. In this case, it's a very curious album, Kelly Blue, because most of it's a trio, but we're going to actually hear him in a medium-sized band setting.
Indeed, and this is probably his best-known album under his own name. I don't think it's necessarily his best. It's a slightly unfocused album in that there's only one or two tracks with expanded lineup, with Benny Golson on tenor sax, Bobby Jasper on flute, Nat Adderley on cornet. And they all take solos, which makes those tracks just a little bit too long. And why did he only record the two numbers with them? The rest of them tracks are trio tracks. So, personally, I prefer the trio tracks, but I think the augmented lineup tracks are interesting because we get to hear Wynton Kelly's writing and his arranging for the larger band, which there aren't many instances of this on record, are there?
There aren't, and this is a very early example of a Kelly composition. It's a piece called Keep It Moving. In fact, there are two different takes on the album, but we're going with the one that was originally issued, noted down on the sleeve as take four. And the thing that strikes me about this, Tim, is the interesting voicing, the way that he uses Bobby Jasper's flute as a very brilliant dynamic in the ensemble.
Yes, it's a shame we haven't got more recorded examples of Wynton Kelly arrangements as opposed to all his wonderful piano solos. Thank you.
Keep It Moving, composed and arranged by Wynton Kelly, the pianist, with Nat Adderley, Benny Golson, Bobby Jasper, Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb in February 1959 from the album Kelly Blue on Riverside. And as you were saying, Tim, this was just about the moment that Wynton joined the Miles Davis Band. We heard Freddie Freeloader at the beginning of the programme, and this rhythm section of Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb was to become a pretty regular partnership for him. Although, actually, in the next album we're going to hear, which is one of a number that Wynton recorded with the saxophonist Hank Mobley, the drum chair has been taken over by the absolutely inimitable Art Blakey. This is the album Soul Station, and it's interesting to hear this group, which is in some senses Miles's next iteration of his band, but with Art playing the drums instead of Jimmy Cobb.
Yes, and of course, I suppose that at the time, Wynton Kelly didn't know that Paul Chambers and Jimmy Cobb would be his trio for the next 6 years or whatever. But as that's what's happening, we'll be hearing a lot more from them later on, won't we, in the programme?
We will, but I think it's interesting here that Art Blakey brings a different dynamic. He seems to be just the right drummer, with that slight shuffle feel to his playing, behind the mid-tempo groove that Wynton absolutely specialised in.
Yes, I love this album, Soul Station. And the track Soul Station as well is another one that we could have played. It's very hard to choose.
We're actually starting with Dig Dis.
And Hank Mobley sounds so bluesy. He was later to join the Miles Davis Band, wasn't he? And he replaced Coltrane.
Yeah, we'll hear that just a little bit later on. But I think this is exceptional too, because Hank is a soloist who went on to make, as I said, a number of albums for Blue Note with this or a slightly different version of this rhythm section with Wynton on piano. Here it seems that they've already got a partnership that really works for the two of them.
Absolutely.
Hank Mobley and Dig Dist from the album Soul Station on Blue Note, recorded in February 1960 with Wynton Kelly on piano, Paul Chambers bass and Art Blakey drums. You're listening to Jazz Library on BBC Radio 3 with me, Alan Shipton, and my guest Tim Richards discussing the music of pianist Wynton Kelly. And there'll be full details of all the music in today's programme on the website. That's bbc.co.uk/radio3/jazzlibrary. Tim, we are going to move now to hearing Wynton in the trio setting that we didn't hear from the album Kelly Blue, except that, unlike most of the trios from this period, the one session made for the VJ label, Philly Joe Jones, Mars's former drummer, came in to work with them. So we've got Paul Chambers again on bass, Wynton on piano, and Philly Joe, who starts innocuously but pretty quickly stirs things up as only he can.
Yes, listen to the interaction between the piano right hand and Philly's snare drum and his bass drum and the accents that he puts in. It's just perfect. It really brings it alive. It's a shame that Wynton didn't make more recordings with Philly Joe. Of course, I would imagine from his point of view, because Philly Joe was in the Miles Davis band previously with Red Garland on piano, it must have been quite something for Wynton to suddenly be recording with Philly Joe. Must have been a little bit also, you know, coming in after Bill Evans and Red Garland. That's a hell of a piano lineage. And I think one of the things that Miles and others have said is that Wynton's playing was almost like a combination of Bill Evans and Red Garland. He kind of had the best of both worlds.